argument, United States v. Gallardo. Ms. Christensen.
May it please the Court. Counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joanna Christensen with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant David Gallardo in this case. Mr. Gallardo served as essentially an errand boy for his brother Ricardo for 6 weeks in a 3.5-year conspiracy. However, the district court denied his request for a 2-level reduction for minor role because the court determined...
Well, it was 3 weeks because he was arrested, right? It could have gone on forever.
It was actually six weeks, Your Honor, but it had gone on for a long time.
But it would continue indefinitely. I mean, it's not as if he dropped out. He got tired of...
That's true, but that would be true for everybody. It would have continued and continued to be an even larger conspiracy. His role might have gotten more significant. We don't know that because he was arrested. But looking at what he did do in the conspiracy that existed was a minor participant in this case.
But that was he involved a lot of trust and handled a lot of money, apparently.
He did, in fact, handle a lot of money, approximately 18 kilograms of cocaine and a kilogram of heroin. But if you look at the entire conspiracy, it involved at least 240 kilograms of cocaine, according to the government, and possibly much more.
So even though you have a huge amount that he handled, both money and drugs, but you're comparing it relative to everybody else,
absolutely,
he was minor, even though in another case, this would be a huge amount.
Absolutely. If this was a case that was only 6 weeks long and only involved around 20 kilograms of cocaine and some heroin and $280,000, if that was essentially most of the conspiracy, he wouldn't be requesting and wouldn't qualify for a minor role. But if you look at the entire conspiracy, which the district court should have done when comparing the role, you look at, by the government's estimation, Mr. Gallardo was only involved in 10% of the drugs, certainly, and that may or may not be a correct assumption. That's what I believe Mr. Espinoza pled guilty to.
Did the success of the conspiracy in terms of income increase when he joined it?
I'm not aware of the number specifically because in David Gallardo's file, there's only really, you know, some basic knowledge about the rest of the conspiracy. But my understanding is that they had been going strong for quite some time, buying cars, buying assets, making trap cars, and transporting drugs all over the country. It had been going on for a long time, presumably in the same strength. It may have strengthened simply because they were gearing up, they were keeping going, and it may have gotten broader that way. But it certainly was in no relation to David Gallardo's participation.
You're looking at a conspiracy as activity rather than as an agreement. So what if this fellow had been hired as the CEO of the gang, but then the next day they're all arrested? Would you call him a minor participant?
I think it depends on what his involvement was. If he was basically
He's hired. He's to be the CEO of the gang. He's replacing its previous leader. And the next day they're all arrested. So he hasn't actually done anything, but he had been hired as the CEO. So my question is, would that make him a minor participant in your view?
I think certainly there would be an argument for that.
Yeah, but I don't agree with that argument. Because I think a conspiracy is an agreement. And if you are the number one guy, the fact that you're new and haven't done anything doesn't detract from the fact that you are a major participant in the conspiracy.
I agree that a conspiracy is an agreement, but the role in the offense is based on participation and the scope of the conspiracy.
Yeah, but he joined.
Participation in the conspiracy is different from participation in the overt acts committed by the conspiracy.
I'm not sure that I agree with that distinction. I think that the law on the minor role reduction, you have to consider the conspiracy as a whole and the defendant's actions within it.
Conspiracy as a whole means you're treating the conspiracy as the activity pursuant to the conspiracy. Conspiracy is the agreement. And I'm suggesting you can be a major participant because of your role in the agreement, your designated position, even though you've been before you were able to carry out your duties, you were arrested.
I think that certainly can be one consideration, but I think
what
that
the cases say.
The cases say that it's based on the defendant's participation, the scope and the conspiracy, and the comparative roles
of all
participants.
Well, that's not answering the question, right? Because conspiracy can mean two different things, the activity and the agreement. So are there any cases which discuss this distinction I'm suggesting?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but I certainly would be willing to submit something.
Yeah, right.
I see that my...
Well, I'd just like to point one thing. Now, in joining this conspiracy, he obviously knew how big it was. He was hired as a trusted person to handle 20 kilograms and $275,000. I think that's, in following Judge Posner's question on the CEO, he joined something that he knew was major and made a major contribution in a short period of time.
I think he knew that it was major based on what he handled, but at the change of plea hearing, the government stated, when the district court asked Mr. Gallardo about other participants, the government stated, well, he knew it was a big thing, but he may not have known all the parts of it. I think that implies that he joined it, and he knew that it was a large conspiracy based on what he was handling, but was not aware, certainly, of all of the money laundering, which he had no involvement in whatsoever.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Christensen.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Price?
Please, the court. My name is Elliot Price. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Ricardo Gallardo, who's presumptively the leader of this gang, as it's been called. What I'd like to do is just start off by saying, in an attempt to avoid duplication, I adopted Mr. Taylor's brief in connection with this juror note issue, and he's going to argue that issue. I did file a reply, but there's no point in both of us arguing. So while it's a serious issue, I'm going to argue something else at this point. Okay, if I may. The essence of this case is from beginning to end the problem of the witnesses and how much was involved in this conspiracy. If anything, they put three witnesses on a stand. We had PSIs showing all these folks had been using drugs for a considerable period of time. We thereafter had an expert witness who was qualified to testify about drug usage and what it could do to a person. We then got into this area with the court as to what questions we could ask.
Did this proposed expert, did he examine these people?
No, sir. He examined.
Well, wouldn't you have to do that? Wouldn't you have to examine them, see if their brains are damaged? Or?
Well, I don't think that could ever occur, number one. No one would have allowed us to do that.
Why?
Well, Your Honor, it might be a good idea to try to do that in the future, but at that time, we were working off the statements of these people as to what they had done in the past. And he was saying, if you use that much drugs, he was qualified as an expert. The court accepted him as an expert. He was from the University of Illinois. He was the chief of chemistry there and prepared to testify to the effect on the body from that amount of use of drugs over that period of time.
You have to do it on an individual basis.
Well, they all were doing drugs, Your Honor. I mean, they all admitted to using them.
No. But the effect of drugs on an individual's memory depends on the individual. You can't just make a blanket assertion that everybody who uses drugs has bad memory.
Let me add to that. When we attempted to go into that with the individual defendants who had gone to the other side, the court said we could only ask them if they were an addict on the date they testified. And he said, and by the way, I know if you ask them the question, they're going to say no anyway. So I'm not going to allow you to go into their backgrounds or cross-examine them unless perhaps you have something independent evidence whatsoever. Well, unless you have somebody from the street that saw this guy stoned out of his mind one day, you're not going to have it. The four-part test on Yarborough, okay, and the suggested instruction, which I believe was dicta, was in the footnotes, suggested that had they been able to get into this information, how could we possibly get into it? He prevented us. He would not allow us to go into it. He said, you can't do it. You want to say he's an addict today? All three of these guys are doing time. Who would possibly say they were an addict on that day? Addicts, unfortunately, the day you're an addict, you're an addict for the rest of your life. Like an alcoholic, maybe. It's unfortunate. But if we have to try to, in the next case, perhaps, examine these people medically, maybe that's the way to go. But we were hamstrung here by people who use drugs on a regular basis. We couldn't cross-examine them, and we couldn't get an instruction. So in that sense, we now come to the issue about how much drugs are involved in this conspiracy. One of them says, I don't know. The other one says, well, why don't we just say 150? Next guy says, well, why don't we just say 500? That is even that's just pure speculation. So the court said, well, I think it was at least 150. How do we come to that conclusion? We have no money trail. We have no assets to suggest drugs at that level. None of the
you ask the judge to order these people, or order them to be given a medical examination, psychiatric examination?
No, sorry, not so.
Why not?
Because I don't think that examination is necessary if they testify or they give a PSI that says, I was doing this kind of drug for this kind of period.
Look, the problem is the fact that a person has been a heavy drug user, that doesn't establish how much of his memory is gone. To do that, you'd have to examine the individual. You have to examine the individual. The individual examined by a neurologist or someone who knows about these things. You could ask the judge, couldn't you, to?
Judge,
this is a sentencing issue, right?
Well, a trial was an issue about their credibility as what was going on, okay, with regard to their activities.
I thought your concern was primarily the amount.
Well, yes. Yes, at the time of sentencing, we are saying, yes, these individuals, their words alone, forget the addiction problem. Let's say it's this. Let's say it's that. Let's say it's a million. Let's pick any number out of the year we want to. And the judge says, well, okay, I'll say it's 150. So there was no credible evidence there except some language that was really innocuous. And there was a few cars purchased, which wouldn't add up to maybe $100,000 at that. Okay, nobody was living high. I mean, nobody in this whole group.
Okay, yes, we'll have to move on, Mr. President.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Your time has expired.
Just one comment,
okay,
please.
Sure.
Your Honor, I was astounded by the judge's statement at the time of sentencing. I think it was unreasonable to impose 30 years here for the reason that after sentencing him, he said, you know, you can use your time in jail, do some good things, and who knows, maybe the law will change or this case will get reversed or remanded. I think it's almost cruel and unusual punishment to say something like that to somebody, Judge. I couldn't believe my ears. And thank you for your time today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Price. Mr. Taylor?
Good morning, Your Honor. I may please the court. My name is Christopher Taylor, and I represent Mr. Luna in connection with these cases. And I have two issues to address to the court, one being the sufficiency of the evidence against him, and the more important issue, the one that I think is dispositive of the appeal, is the issue of these juror notes.
All right, well, why don't you go to that issue?
And during the course of the trial, Mr. Price actually first noticed and then communicated to me, and we both noticed, one of the jurors had material with him that he was reading in the jury box that was not...
Well, what do you mean by material?
Well, we were not allowed to ascertain exactly what the material was. He had some sort of paperwork that was not the note paperwork provided by the court for the taking of notes. We then, perceiving this to be a very important issue, asked the court to inquire what these outside extraneous materials were, and the court refused to do so. The court...
Why was that?
Well, you know, the trial judge indicated, well, maybe it's just notes from his wife or something of that nature. It chose to speculate and not even inquire. And not being satisfied with that answer, I asked the district court judge to replace that juror with an alternate if the court was not
How far into the trial was this? Did this happen?
I must confess I do not recall. It was early on, I would say. I don't believe it was. I can't remember if it was the first day or the second day. We noticed this, and we did everything that we could to ascertain what these materials were. We asked the district court judge to voir dire the juror. We asked that the juror be replaced with an alternate. I asked for a mistrial at the time, and I think that the state of the law is clear that under those circumstances, the trial court judge has a duty to examine what the possible outside influence was.
Had he made any preliminary instructions saying you're confined to those notebooks or something like that?
I believe he made statements that you should not consider outside evidence. However, it became clear that somebody brought something from the outside into the jury room.
And once that was noticed and you all brought it up, then he made a general instruction because he didn't want to separate out the one juror and said you shouldn't, whatever, the thing that he did not apparently say at the outset. He said don't bring anything else in or something like that.
Right, that is very much true, but that is not the procedure that the cases indicate is the proper procedure. There are Seventh Circuit cases on this issue, and the
What exactly did you say? I still don't understand what you mean by these materials.
Well, and that's the sad thing. No matter what we do, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to answer for Your Honor the question of what these materials were. We noticed that
I'm just asking you what it looked like. What did you see?
It was some time ago, but it was paperwork that was not the same type of...
What do you mean by paperwork?
I can't recall
sheets
exactly.
Of paper?
Sheets of paper, yes. Indeed, sheets of paper that was not consistent with being the note-taking material.
What did you tell the judge?
We told the judge that we had noticed this juror holding these materials and reading them in the courtroom, and that when we initially made the point, the judge cautioned the juror not to, cautioned all the jurors not to be...
Did the judge see these materials?
Yes, he did. But he never saw them close enough to examine what, in fact, they were. The cases are quite clear. The
notes, a book, a magazine?
And I really wanted to know that, Judge, just as Your Honor appears to want to know that. And I did everything that a lawyer can do to ascertain what those materials were. And then when I was denied the opportunity that I should have been given to see what those materials were, I asked for the appropriate relief, replace the juror with an alternate or... grant a mistrial. None of those things were done, and the clear press...
What position did the government's lawyer take?
I do not recall. I think he said... I don't recall what his position was, but the Supreme Court case in Remmer makes it quite clear, and that was cited by Mr. Price in his reply brief. I didn't file my own because I didn't want to unnecessarily duplicate his, but the Remmer case makes it clear that in those circumstances... A trial judge has the duty to ascertain what the materials were. And this court, in the Bashawi case, which is 272 F3rd 458, cited
was
back
this
to Remmer.
The last day of the trial? Or
no, it was early on in the trial.
Were these materials seen again?
No, they were not.
Well, the judge did. Didn't he wait and look at them himself from a distance? Because he hadn't noticed them before. I thought that's what he said.
No, he never examined the materials.
No, I know he didn't examine them, but he looked at them from the same distance that you did. He apparently hadn't noticed it or something, and then when you all brought it up, then he saw the juror with whatever he had from a distance and then decided to give the general instruction, and he thought that was enough.
Right, and I'm asking Your Honors to say to him that's not enough and follow the Bashawi case.
The indication the juror took it in with him or her, whatever, into the deliberations.
Well, not into the deliberations, but into the jury room during the trial is sufficient, in my estimation.
But it was in the jury box. You wouldn't see anything in the jury room.
Well, when the point was raised for the trial judge and the judge said, you know, don't be considering outside information, he stuck it in his coat pocket and took it into the jury room with him. It was not
in the jury room, but not into the deliberations, as far as you know.
And as far as we know, no, we have no.
Back when the juror came back when the trial resumed. He didn't pull it out again.
No, we did not see it again. Thank you, Your Honors. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. So, Mr. Peterson?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Do you recall what the government did when the issue was raised about the extraneous documents held by that juror?
Your Honor, honestly, I can't recall specifically, but I believe what our position was that we left it to the court's discretion. And as far as what the item was, basically, I think the record shows, and from my recollection, was that there was a piece of paper folded up in a juror's pocket in the jury box. And that's all the evidence there was of any information.
Folded up in his pocket? What does that mean?
Like, took a piece of paper and folded it up. And
sticking
out of his pocket so that you could see it. Yeah,
he didn't have a coat on.
Front shirt pocket, yeah.
So it was, I see, so it was just sticking out of his pocket?
Correct.
He wasn't looking at it?
No, Your Honor. And I don't think the record reflects anyone observing that juror doing that. Personally, I don't believe any of the...
Well, surely the judge hadn't said you can't have anything in your pockets during the trial.
Right? He did not say that, or he certainly did say that. I'm sorry.
He didn't say you have to empty your pockets.
No, he didn't. He also didn't tell...
So presumably people have notes or notebooks or calendars or what have you.
And as far as I know, the women on the jury were not asked to empty out their purses before they, you know, the women were not asked to empty out their purses as well, Your Honor.
I assume all of this we're talking about is on the record. It's not, is it?
Correct, Your Honor. Well, there's nothing in the record that the jurors were ever asked to empty their pockets.
No, I understand that. I'm talking about the discussion between counsel and the judge with regard to the material that the juror apparently had in his pocket.
Yes, and I'd also like to clarify as well, counsel indicated that the discussion took place towards the end of the trial. I don't recall if it was I believe the trial lasted 6 days. The transcript cite to these arguments is page 1057, I believe. I believe it was either the Friday of the first week of the trial or the Thursday, one of those two, but it was towards the end of the trial. The testimony was almost concluded, and we're getting ready to do closing arguments. So it was not at the beginning of the trial.
So did he have something in his pocket every day?
Not that it was ever brought up by anyone.
Well, I assume it would have shown up just as early, sticking out of his shirt pocket.
Correct.
But this is a case, again, so we get the script of what you and the judge was looking at, all counsel, was somebody with no coat on and some sort of shirt that had a
button shirt with a pocket.
With a pocket.
And that's a piece of paper in it.
And your recollection is it was never removed or read during the time that you were...
No one indicated that they observed that. I didn't observe it. There's nothing in the record that indicates that anybody saw that individual referring to it while the testimony was occurring. And the judge had instructed the jurors prior to the commencement of the trial that they were not to rely on any outside sources of information, not to attempt to look things up on the Internet. And then again, after this issue came up, reminded them as well. And absent the evidence that there was actually any outside influence on the jurors, there's been no report that any of the jurors were given outside materials or referred to those materials in their deliberations. The defendant's argument fails when they're trying to say that the judge abused his discretion by not having a hearing or not inquiring of that juror what was in his pocket. I mean, by that token, should all of the jurors have been asked what they had in their pockets? I mean, something as innocuous as a piece of paper in someone's pocket when they were not told that they could not bring other papers in there. During the trial, there were, as the judge noted, there were recesses, and the jurors were sent back to the jury room. It could have been anything, and there's no indication that it was anything that would have improperly influenced their verdict.
Does the judge allow the jurors to take notes?
Yes, he provided them with notebooks. And after this was brought to his attention, he instructed them not to use any other papers other than the notebooks to take their notes. Unless there's any other questions in regards to that issue, I'll move on to the other issues. The first being the appeal of David Gallardo, where he has indicated here today that through his counsel that he was only an errand boy. I would dispute that based on the evidence. The judge correctly found that he was not a minor participant in this offense, and it was the defendant's burden to prove that. The judge found that he was not, by a preponderance of the evidence, a minor participant, and that's clearly supported by the record. The fact that even though he was only involved in the conspiracy for that brief period of time, he basically wants a double benefit. He wants to say, well, I should only be held accountable for that brief period of time I was involved, and then because it was only a brief period of time, I should get even a further reduction. And that's just not consistent with what a minor participant, what that entails. So we would ask that you deny the defendant's appeal in regards to that issue.
What was his sentence?
I believe he was sentenced to 77 months, Your Honor.
It's 87.
I'm sorry, 87 months. And as to the final issue that was argued here today regarding the issue of drug abuse by the government's witnesses, the defendants basically have failed to develop a record that they can rely on now to argue that the judge erred. The judge gave them options. They didn't even take the step of asking the government's witnesses if they were currently addicts, saying that it was futile or, you know, that's just not...
Yeah. Well, could they have asked the judge to order a medical examination of these people? Suppose you have a witness who you have some reason to think might be mentally impaired. What does one do in such a case?
They certainly could have made that motion. They did not do so.
Is the judge authorized to order a medical examination? I suppose he could say, well, if you want to testify, or if the government wants to present this witness, you'll have to have him examined.
They could make the motion, but I think they'd also have to make some showing beyond the fact that they'd used drugs in the past. I mean, there's no evidence in the record that shows that any of these witnesses were impaired by their prior drug use. So if they could make that showing, I suppose the judge could order an evaluation of those witnesses, but in this case, they came far short.
I think he probably could do it at a sentencing hearing where he's the fact finder, but does that ever come up in a trial where someone says one of the witnesses is loony or retarded or what have you? Is there any procedure for having a witness examined in it?
Your
Honor, move to exclude a witness as mentally incompetent? I suppose you could do that, couldn't you?
I believe you could, Your Honor, and then it would be litigated prior to trial.
To what extent could they examine him as far as past drug use?
During the trial?
Mm-hmm.
Or the judge indicated that they would be allowed to ask the defendants, the witnesses, whether or not they had previously, or whether or not they were currently addicts, whether they were under the influence of drugs at the time that the transactions that they testified to occurred. But
didn't he draw a line right after that or something where
right.
He didn't go into other things?
But just as far as whether or not they had used drugs in the past, I mean, that would just have been a character attack on all the witnesses with really no relevance to their testimony. And certainly there were other individuals that were associated with these individuals, so if they were in fact impaired during these time periods, which the judge indicated they could do, they could bring in witnesses to testify that they were under the influence of drugs during the time periods that these transactions that they testified to took place. The judge also said they could bring in those witnesses as well.
And with regard to Judge Posner's question about a procedure, I don't know about you, but I've never seen that sort of thing done where there's been a medical or psychiatric exam of a witness. Have you?
No, I haven't. And like I said, I believe...
It couldn't be, maybe, but...
Right. Well, I think once the motion would be made, there would have to be some showing in addition to the fact that the person had previously used drugs. There would be some showing.
Unless it's obvious on the witness stand, for example.
Right. And normally in those type of cases, there'll be a history of mental illness records that wouldn't be necessary for a new examination because you'd be able to bring in their past mental history.
What do you mean you'd be able to bring in the past mental history?
But if
how'd you get hold of it?
Pardon me?
How would a defendant get hold of a witness's medical records?
Well, if the government was aware of it, they'd have to disclose it.
Oh, is exculpatory Brady material, you mean?
I would think it would be
could these witnesses be asked whether they had been using drugs during the period about which they're testifying?
The judge...
He asked about whether they had been using drugs during the period about which they are testifying.
I believe the judge limited it further, indicating that they could be asked if they were under the influence of drugs during the time, during the events that they were testifying to.
They could be asked about that.
That was my understanding.
Drug users when the events occurred that they testified about.
I believe that's what the judge indicated.
I'm sure I'm being clear. Defendants could ask whether they were currently drug addicts or currently under the influence of drugs, but could they also ask whether they had been under the influence of drugs during the period about which they were testifying?
I want to be clear, Your Honor, if I could just have a moment. Your Honor, I believe what the ruling was that the court indicated that the witnesses could not be questioned about their drug use during the transactions. At least, I'm sorry, and this only relates to the witness Espinoza because the defendants did not make any attempt to ask any questions of the other two witnesses, Fricks or Wilson. But the court indicated that they would not, the defendants would be barred from asking any questions about Mr. Espinoza's prior drug use. However, that they would not be precluded from introducing evidence during their case to show that at the time he conducted the transactions, he was under the influence of drugs, so that he could not have remembered what occurred.
So. I don't understand that. They could present evidence that Espinoza had been under the influence of drugs during the...
Through other witnesses.
About which he was testifying, but they couldn't ask him about it?
Because the court specifically found, based on his direct testimony and his observations of Mr. Espinoza, that his memory was not impaired, although he would allow them to bring in evidence that refuted that conclusion.
I don't understand. How can you, by listening to a witness, know whether his memory is impaired? Because maybe what he was testifying about was a fantasy induced by some drug experience during that period. Right? Suppose a year ago, suppose he's testifying about something that happened a year ago, and his testimony is perfectly coherent and so on, but because he was under the influence of drugs a year ago, what he's testifying happened is just some hallucination. So wouldn't it be appropriate to allow the defendant's lawyer to ask Espinoza, well, that a year ago when these events you're testifying to allegedly occurred, were you sober or were you under the influence of drugs? Why wouldn't that be an appropriate question?
Your Honor, because the defendants had not made any showing that Mr. Espinoza had been under the influence of drugs during that time period.
Sure, but why don't you just say, why not? So ask him, right?
Well, and the government did ask.
So, pardon?
That question had already been asked
by
the government.
Right. So you, I see. So you had asked him whether he was sober when he, at the time about which he's testifying.
Correct, Your Honor. And furthermore,
cross examiners frequently ask the same question that was asked on direct examination. Why couldn't someone say, well, you testified that, you know, you were sober back then, but are you sure you didn't have any drugs? You didn't even have a little cocaine from time to time?
You're going to examine and ask a question that suggests a contrary answer. Shouldn't they at least have some evidence to show that he was under the influence of drugs at that time? Otherwise, all the question serves to do is dirty up the witness and say, well, remind them again that he was using drugs during that time period. And furthermore, all of his testimony was corroborated by the wiretap recorded conversations between him and other defendants in the case. And even if the district court, even if you found that the district court did abuse its discretion and error, any error was harmless given the overwhelming evidence against the defendant.
Could have asked, you were exposed to a lot of drugs at that time. Do you ever keep any for personal use? I mean, that would, could lead you into the question about, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Peterson. So would any of the defendant's lawyers like a moment of rebuttal? Mr. Price? No?
Your Honor, if I may.
Yes, of course.
The issue about the juror is very concerning to me.
Your Honor, I was the one who first observed it. The juror had some papers in his hand along his side that he was reading, his right. He had the notebook in his lap, okay? And when the court admonished the jurors in toto that they shouldn't have extraneous materials, he proceeded with one hand to fold a piece of paper up and shove it in his pants pocket. It was never in his shirt pocket, never in his coat pocket. It went right into his pants pocket when admonished, the jury was admonished. I watched the entire process. And that's why I brought it to the attention of the court initially. And that's all I have
to say.
Of course,
see, part of the problem is, I know how difficult it is, but you've got to make a record at the time.
We did.
Okay, well, then we'll find it.
You'll find, I guess I wanted to extrapolate
but
that.
But we're certainly going to examine the record closely at that time. But whatever record you made had to be, as you know.
That'll be the state of the matter. Thank you.
Fine. Thank you very much, Mr. Price. And thanks to all three of you. Of course, we have a defender, and you, and Mr. Price, Mr. Taylor, were you appointed?
I was retained on this case.
Well, we thank you for your efforts, and also, of course, Mr. Peterson.